I'm your host, Kevin Barrett, bringing you all the news that's not fit to print in the New York Times. And right now, as we're moving into election season, and Israeli Prime Minister, radical extremist Zionist Netanyahu, throws himself into the American election campaign, apparently trying to force Obama to attack Iran for Israel, or failing that, to get his good buddy Romney elected. Everybody is tearing their hair out, wondering what in the world is going on. Is Netanyahu overplaying his hand? What does he think he's doing? Grant Smith is perhaps our greatest pure researcher on the Israeli lobby's death grip on the USA. As he puts it in his latest book, Divert, there has been a veritable explosion of Israeli lobby crime on U.S. soil, ranging from election fraud, charitable and for-profit criminal fronts, money laundering, 1938 Foreign Agent Registration Act and Logan Act violations, industrial and economic espionage, health and environmental outrages, and even a few unexplained assassinations. The key facts around which are only slowly emerging. Well, that says it pretty well. That verified explosion of Israeli lobby crime might even be tied into those explosions that took down the World Trade Center. I'm pretty convinced it is. But Grant, in his new book, does tell us about another Israeli nuclear crime, that is the diversion of all kinds of weapon grades material to the Israeli nuclear program. It's an amazing story, and it really just blows your mind, the extent of the impunity of these foreign spies who can just run roughshod over the whole country. I'm still scratching my head over it, so let's ask Grant about it. Welcome, Grant Smith. How are you?
Hey, Kevin. It's great to be back on your show after a couple of years that went by there.
It's been a whole couple of years. Wow. Yeah, well, but, got a new book out.
Yeah, I'm glad you finally received a review copy. We've been sending out a few. The full title is called Divert, Numek Zalman Shapiro and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. Kind of a mouthful, but it really does go into the things that you talk about, kind of this symbiotic relationship between Israel lobbying organizations in the United States, the Israeli government, their undercover operatives. And you would think that given all of the facts that have emerged around this, it's a much easier thing to research because so much time has passed, that this would provide a lot of context for what's going on right now. But, of course, it can't, because that's not what the conglomerate news organizations do.
It's interesting. There really isn't any competition in our big media around this.
No.
I guess the Veterans Today and a few other publications like that, you know, What Really Happens, a compilation of news stories. There are a few places on the Internet where you can get the other side of the story and hear the truth about some of these things. But the whole corporate media, the whole so-called alternative media, pseudo-alternative media, the left media, you know, the public access media even, practically.
Right.
PBS, they're all afraid to take this on.
Well, I used to assume good faith. You know, 10 years ago, I would put out a report or put out a news release and then sit by the phone and wait for the mainstream organizations to come calling. And, you know, that's what used to happen when I was researching other topics. But, boy, you cannot assume good faith in this field. You just have to assume that half of what you're getting is either, you know, just covering something else, or it's the opposite of what's happening. And so it's, you know, you mentioned a few outlets. Every outlet that is starved for money and constantly raising funds and has a tiny budget, you can assume that they're doing good work.
Pretty much, yeah. I think that covers American Freedom Radio. At least I
haven't
seen a six-figure Christmas bonus check from them yet.
No, not yet. I'm sure it's in the mail.
That's right. Yeah, it's funny. It's you know, there's such a huge financial factor in this. That is, people are worried about having any money if they speak the truth on the Israel-Palestine issue and the, you know, Israeli control of the U.S. issue.
Right.
Everybody. When I was in the academy, you That's the first thing you kind of hear is that, no, you don't want to go quite that far.
Right, right. We don't use that word. We don't use the other word. And Maureen Dodd dipped just one manicured toe into this cesspool of controversy by suggesting that Mitt Romney is surrounded by neoconservatives who were responsible for the Iraq debacle. And, of course, she was immediately smeared by, you know, the counter apparatus. And, you know, she didn't say enough to get fired. But you have almost weekly reminders about why the bigger organizations that have a financial stake and they're commercially run and they have, you know, advertisers that they have to respond to, why they just will not do any service in this area.
And people must be terrified, you know, because every time someone like Maureen Dodd even breathes a word of truth,
right,
they line up a firing squad, and you know, if they don't actually fire, as they have at Helen Thomas, and who is that guy on one of the TV networks who said something like, oh, these, you know, they're all from the same ethnic group, and boom, he's gone.
Right.
You know, any truth about this, and you're unemployable in the media.
Well, yeah, and but the one big difference is that now it's highly visible, and of course there are all sorts of online sites where people are talking about this and really outraged by it. And I don't think there's any better example of the corrupting influence of the Israel lobby than what happened at the Democratic Convention, where the majority of delegates didn't want to insert any sort of references to Jerusalem being the capital of Israel. And, of course, the machine just rolled over them, barely stopped to kind of pick, you know, bones and flesh off the treads.
You know, and that was like a Monty Python sketch. It was so bad. You know,
but think of what would have happened before online media and viral videos. That would have become perhaps a rumor between, you know, a small informed circle. Now it just shows why this Israel lobby, which attains power through corrupt means, has become such a threat to average Americans, because it subverts virtually everything it touches.
And more people in the military and intelligence services and people formerly in those services seem to be coming around to this point of view. I've gotten to, maybe it's just me getting to know more of these people since I started hanging around Veterans Today and, you know, talking to whistleblowers like Gwyneth Todd and Susan Lindauer. But from what these people tell me, you know, they're not the only people. They're not like, you know, one in a million who happens to not like having the U.S. completely dominated by Israel. They say that there's massive, festering, seething resentment under the surface.
Right. But, of course, those are usually mid-level or lower-level people. I recall talking to one who was on the Reagan Task Force on Terrorism, which was coming together in the early 80s, and this was the same time Benjamin Netanyahu was making a name for himself as a terrorism expert, establishing the Jonathan Netanyahu Institute and all of that. And this person who was on the Reagan Terrorism Task Force said, we were allowed to, you know, run free and study this problem and do everything that we could analysis-wise except for look at causes. And, of course, that's what makes, you know, terrorism experts, and the majority of them are pseudo experts, with the exception of Robert Pape and a few others. They don't want to look at cause. They don't want to look at fact. They don't want to do any serious analysis that might actually serve the American people. They want to use it as a stalking horse, basically.
Well, right, and they're taking money from the same source as the people who were doing a lot of the terrorism. You know, we now know that much of the biggest terrorism is what they call state-sponsored false flag terrorism that's usually designed to foster a strategy of tension, as Operation Gladio people put it. That is, that if there's enough terror and fear in the hearts of the people, if they're afraid of some threat, then they will run to the government for protection. So who has a motive to create all of this terrorism? It's the government. And I think the biggest terrorist outrages generally are examples of this kind of state-sponsored false flag terrorism.
Well, that was the argument that came out of the book The Terrorism Industry by Edward Herman and Gary O'Sullivan back in the 80s. It's kind of a counterpoint to the emerging industry where you couldn't actually name, for example, the Contras who were running around burning villages as state-sponsored terrorists. You had to redefine them as, you know, freedom fighters and all of that. And there doesn't, you know, one of the great benefits is that the mainstream corporate media will, of course, go along and toe the line and adopt all of this language. And, you know, the again, underlying causes and whether, you know, these organizations are actually slaughtering vast numbers of people gets lost in the language and positioning. So it's extremely frustrating. And I don't see too much successful competition with these dominant narratives. And the fact that, you know, somebody like Benjamin Netanyahu, who in this case, and I'd like to talk about his involvement in nuclear smuggling, this is a person who should have no credibility discussing nuclear issues anywhere. And yet, he's on primetime television and, you know, two major networks in one day. It's absolutely astounding.
Right. So he played a key role in the criminal activity of stealing nuclear material from the U.S. to create a rogue nuclear arsenal in Israel, a country that is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Totally, you can't imagine a more rogue nuclear state than Israel, and he, you know, is involved in these crimes. And now he is screaming his head off, saying that they have to bomb Iran back to the Stone Age, not because Iran actually even has any nuclear weapons at all, but because they're developing some nuclear expertise in their civilian research program.
It's amazing because his role, actually the FBI released some documents, and they didn't do their redaction of all names in the documents, and it turns out that one of the most successful nuclear technology smugglers, who was Richard Kelly Smythe, who back in the mid-80s and late 70s was working with Arnon Milchan, sent 800 Krytrons mislabeled as vacuum tubes to a series of Israeli front organizations, and then he fled the United States until 2001 after he was indicted for that activity. And when he came back, he sat down in a district attorney's office and he named Arnon Milchan as a ringleader intelligence asset of the Israelis, and this is a big Hollywood producer who, you know, worked on Pretty Woman and all of these movies. Mm-hmm. And he also named Benjamin Netanyahu as working not as a furniture company executive, which is what his biography says, but rather at Heli Trading Company, which was the Israeli node that was providing cover for these illegal nuclear technology transfers.
Selling nuclear furniture.
Yeah, exactly, a settee of nuclear triggers. And so, you know, the idea that Netanyahu has any platform to talk about other illicit nuclear programs is laughable on the face of it. And yet, although we've put out press releases over all of the establishment newswire services, Business Wire, PR Newswire, and we've put the documents on the Internet since July 4, there has been, with the exception of some Israeli outfits, there has been no warranted discussion of any of this in any of the mainstream outlets. And any time it's brought up, as I did once on an NPR program of a journalist roundtable, it's immediately shut down. So, you know, this is how bad it is. We can't, I mean, we just absolutely can't have a rational discussion on any of this.
It's kind of humorous that the Israeli media actually will go there sometimes when our media won't. It's why, you know, why would the U.S. media be completely censored and unable?
Well, unfortunately, in this case, they kind of did in Israel what they would do in the United States, which is provide a platform to call the prime minister's office and say, hey, did you really work at Heli Trading? And they, of course, said no, and they said, okay, case closed. And then they said, well, antiwar.com is a news website that has, you know, former intelligence and all of these people writing, and so maybe they were given this as a way to deflate Netanyahu. And that has nothing to do with me. I'm not former any of that, and I'm the one who got the document. So they did as bad a job as the United States outlets would have done had they been given the chance.
But I guess, you know, not even having the chance to print anything,
right,
even worse than
exactly
printing the garbage. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Grant Smith. Grant Smith is the director of the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy. This is Truth Jihad Radio. My guest today is Grant Smith. He's written a number of terrific books. on the subject of Israeli spying in the U.S. and Israeli means of control of the U.S., foreign agents, spy trade, and his newest book, Divert, NUMEC, Zalman Shapiro, and the diversion of U.S. weapons-grade uranium into the Israeli nuclear weapons program are the ones that I've looked at, and wow, what amazing stuff. And, you know, Grant, I actually, in my own sheltered life, I've had two run-ins with people who openly bragged about smuggling stuff for Israel. One, I can tell you his name because this guy, he's probably, I'm sure he's passed away because he was getting on when I knew him when I was a young man. A fellow named Seymour Sinnett in New Jersey. He's an industrialist. And I sailed on his sailboat some, and those days, see, my dad's job was selling sailboat sales to wealthy people. And so we made some friends that way. So I hung out with him. I actually stayed at his house for a while in New Jersey, sailed on his boat. Very nice guy. And Seymour was very open about, you know, I was like a, what, 20-year-old kid, and he was very open about the fact that he had been involved with hanky-panky smuggling all sorts of weapons to Israel. And he was proud of it. And, you know, and then I met another person who was the father of my then-girlfriend, a very nice guy, very smart guy. He was actually a colleague of Wernher von Braun at one point, I think for a number of years. And he also openly bragged about being part of some smuggling stuff to Israel. Now, I didn't get details in either case. I didn't really want them. But it's really interesting that somebody like me, just going through life, would happen to bump into these people who, you know, it seems like these guys were not the least bit concerned about exposing the fact that they had been basically spying for a foreign power and, you know, committing crimes to help Israel. They were very proud of it and very open about it. It seems that a lot of people have complete impunity for this.
And well, the psychology is really, really interesting because when you're doing that sort of violation of arms export controls, in your mind, and this is the mindset that Zalman Shapiro communicated privately, he was involved in the U-235 smuggling, the mindset is, U.S. and Israeli interests are the same. Helping one is helping the other. And so during the post-World War II smuggling that was going on, and it was truly massive and encompassed the entire nation, there were actually meetings between the head of some of the organizations that were smuggling with the FBI director in which they said, what we're doing is illegal, but it will not harm the United States. And this is after a couple of operatives were picked up crossing the border. And if you look at recent cases like Benami Kaddish, who was smuggling all sorts of Patriot missile and other and was caught when his handler gave him a call before he died, and he died recently. You know, what did the judge impose as a fine? $50,000 and no jail time. And so if you are a major league arms export control violator, whether you're Arnon Milchan, Benami Kaddish, Al Schwimmer, who is the founder of Israeli Aircraft Industries and kind of like your father's friend, openly bragged about his smuggling past, the most you can expect, I think, is a presidential pardon, and the least you can expect is complete immunity from any prosecution.
And so how come occasionally an Israeli spy actually gets busted, like Jonathan Pollard, for example?
He's the exception that proves the rule. Name another one. It's other famous consequence.
I was trying to think of
Who's number two? Who is he cellmates with?
No wonder they're trying to get him out. No wonder they're complaining that it's unfair. It is unfair. It's the only Israeli spy in history that ever actually had to pay a price.
Well, he made that argument during his final days before Judge Robinson. He said to Judge Robinson, here is a series of documents proving that the United States does not prosecute Israeli espionage. So what's wrong with you, Judge? And there was something clearly, you know, hadn't gotten the memo or something. But so that is why so many prominent Americans, including it seems like half of the Congress, you know, the mayor, former mayor of New York, Ed Koch, and others are constantly pressuring the Obama administration to release him. And I I believe that he probably will release him in February.
You know, that's a heck of a plea to a judge. Sure, I committed espionage, but I'm the only one that's getting popped for it. I mean, he deserves a Larry Silverstein chutzpah award almost for that.
But listen to the argument. The argument is Israel's always in danger, okay? And by prohibiting me from taking this action, this selfless action of smuggling nuclear material or, you know, weapons designs, or as in the case of Israeli aircraft industries, they were paying Stuart Nozette, who was finally, well, he's number two, I guess. Stuart Nozette was a NASA scientist who was being paid $250,000 to give information to Israeli aircraft industries. But, of course, they never went after Israel aircraft industries, and they've just opened a new Maryland branch with 100 employees. So, you know, who even knows what's going to happen in that place? But, you know, the argument is clear. All I'm doing is protecting this delicate state from being wiped off the map. And so it's brilliant in the fact that it turns the table, and it immediately turns judge, jury, prosecutor, FBI investigator into some sort of would-be war criminal for even, you know, investigating.
We do have freedom of religion here under our First Amendment, so all religions have to be treated equally. So I suppose if I, Kevin Barrett, were to help smuggle nuclear weapons to, let's say, Iran, which is always in danger, it's in a lot of danger right now, and I could say, oh, this poor, fragile state of Iran is you know, in danger of being wiped off the map, so I have to steal American nuclear bombs and hand them to Iran. Somehow I don't think that would fly in court.
Well, it's not, yeah, of course, and there are a lot of other components to the lobby that allow that argument that I just laid out to be successfully made in the case of Israel, and which could not be successfully made for any other country. So.
Right, and this would seem to be an obvious violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution. It's giving the Jewish state an advantage that no other state has. It's giving Jewish Americans an advantage that no other ethnic group or religion has.
I would narrow it down because fortunately, I would say Zionists, and that includes a number, at least two religions that I'm aware of, are the ones who are making the argument. Whereas people who see through all of this are not arguing that. And so somebody like Al Schwimmer, somebody like Zalman Shapiro, they're going to make that argument. But you have to make that, when you make that argument, I think the first person you have to deceive is yourself. And, you know, by successfully doing that, that's, you know, it allows them to live with themselves, I guess. Zalman Shapiro is still around, and I don't think he has any problems with what he did. Al Schwimmer certainly never did. But I wouldn't, you know, in this particular case, one of the things that makes it so successful, if you look at the entire scope of smuggling and crime, is the connectedness and the elite nature of it. And so one of the most closely guarded FBI files is of Henry Morgenthau Jr. And there have been a number of Morgenthaus in terms of district attorneys in New York, Southern District of New York, where a lot of smuggling took place, that turned a blind eye on all of this. Nahum Bernstein, who was a lawyer and operative who would be wiretapping, following, doing covert operations against Arab UN delegations. And he was so interconnected that whenever the FBI looked at his clandestine illegal activities, they would just simply note that his law firm had recently promoted somebody to district attorney and that they were connected with this administration official. And so although the numbers were relatively few hardcore Zionists, they were untouchable. And so those people and crimes are, I think, the proper target.
Well, you know, speaking of untouchable,
yeah,
we have kind of another great example, another candidate for the Larry Silverstein Chutzpah Award would be Steve Rosen, whose defense when he was being busted for spying for Israel was, well, what do you think AIPAC does?
Yeah, exactly.
And then
Steve Rosen.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us.
Well, I think you touched on a really important point because Steve Rosen was connected. He was an Uber lobbyist going after the executive branch who had the temerity to try to get all the goods that the executive branch and Pentagon had so that he could promote a war with Iran, and was very clear that that's what his intention was. But the minute that he broke ranks with AIPAC and sued them for defamation, he had the entire world coming down on his head. And AIPAC promptly hired the best lawyer that they could, who is a techno guy about labor law, and wiped the floor with Steve Rosen in his defamation lawsuit. So although Steve Rosen went into court and told the truth, which is that securing classified information is what AIPAC does best, he couldn't make any headway. And the three-panel appeals court judges that I saw during that particular case, which, by the way, the media didn't cover, I think they understood where the power and money and influence was, and it certainly wasn't Steve Rosen. So he's an example, I think, of a high-level lobbyist who broke ranks and promptly suffered the consequences.
Mm-hmm. They seem to have a pretty tight ship. It's rather shocking in a way that they're able to enforce that kind of discipline. Anybody gets out of line like he did.
Yeah, I think you're right that the ship is tight, but just like any mainstream journalist isn't going to follow Maureen Dodd into the pool, any lobbyist who has a problem is going to grumble internally. But, you know, there are people, again, like Douglas Bloomfield, who is kind of in Steve Rosen's position in the early 80s, and he was involved in obtaining all sorts of U.S. industry secrets, and the FBI actually investigated as an espionage and theft of government property. But by just staying connected with the lobby, even after he left the employment of AIPAC, he gets all sorts of benefits and writing opportunities, and he can become an elder statesman. By accusing AIPAC of defamation and spilling some secrets, although I'm certain he could have spilled a lot more, but by spilling some secrets in court, Steve Rosen really harmed his future prospects for employment. And I think, you know, now, with hindsight, he probably regrets what he did. And he showed that he wasn't as smart as certainly he thought he was. But one of the advantages that I have that you don't and a lot of other researchers don't is that I tend to look at things where I at least have a hope of getting solid documentary evidence that doesn't rely too much on outside expertise, because goodness knows within any government agency there are always dissidents and people who disagree, usually at mid and lower levels, who produce a documentary record of what's really going on. And so I have the advantage in just about everything I research and publish about, which, again, is not always all that current, but is certainly relevant, of having a really solid documentary record. And I'm not denigrating people who are trying to really get to the bottom of 9/11, but what I'm saying is I have an advantage that they don't.
I'm Kevin Barrett talking with Grant Smith, the premier researcher on the subject of Israeli spying on the U.S. and Israel's death grip on our government. We'll be right back. This is Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett talking today, for this hour, with Grant Smith. His new book is called Divert, Numic, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program. And Grant, in the book, let me quote a passage here. From the first day, Israel's weapons were squarely, though probably not literally, pointed at America. Nuclear coercion of the United States for conventional weapons and unconditional diplomatic support, called nuclear coercion by realists and blackmail by the less charitable, has long been perceivable to the observant. And then you continue, the Kennedy administration was dead set against a nuclear-armed Israel and did everything in its power to stop it, up to the very moment of JFK's assassination. The Johnson administration, of course, then ended that. So two very interesting issues come up in that very short passage. One is Israeli nuclear blackmail of
right.
the U.S. That is,
sure.
can Netanyahu be actually using his nuclear power right now to be blackmailing Obama into going to war with Iran, for example? And secondly, is there a possibility of Israeli involvement in the JFK assassination? And if so, you know, we've had a major Jewish newspaper editor shamed because he published an editorial essentially calling for Israel to assassinate Obama. And there are all these rumors of Israel possibly assassinating Obama. So these two weapons, nuclear blackmail and potential presidential assassination, have been issues in the past. And do you think that they're still issues today?
Well, now we're talking conspiracies I know something about.
That's what I do on the show.
Okay. Well, let me put it this way. Here's the number one conspiracy, okay? The U.S. had a couple of choices after it saw nuclear materials and technology illicitly flowing to Israel. It could have said, under Kennedy or Johnson, hey, this has to stop, you have to give it back. It could have criminally prosecuted Zalman Shapiro and members of the Zionist Organization of America who are on his board. It could have taken down Rafael Eitan, who was later became Pollard's handler when he visited the plant. But it didn't do any of those things. Instead, it pacted this policy of strategic ambiguity with Golda Meir when she visited Nixon, and even though Kissinger and Nixon knew that they were mounting all of these weapons on intermediate-range missiles, they decided to pretend to talk about Israel's nuclear arsenal. And so the question, who is that policy targeted to? Conspiracy between the administration and the Israelis. Was it targeted against the region? No, because the region knows Israel has nuclear weapons. Was it targeted against the Israelis? No. It was really targeted against the Americans, because just like at the Democratic National Convention, if this had been put to any sort of plebiscite or public input, people would have said, no, you can't, you shouldn't transfer nuclear weapons to the Israelis. And so what you have is a policy that flies in the face of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and probably really pulled the U.S. out of compliance, since, as the General Accounting Office found out in a 1978 report that we had declassified in 2010, the U.S. didn't take any bona fide actions against this diversion. And so who is this aimed against? It's really aimed against Americans. This real American conspiracy of strategic ambiguity and not talking about Israel's nuclear weapons, even when some brave soul like Helen Thomas tries to pull it out of the president's mouth, it's aimed at Americans who passed, through their legislators, all sorts of amendments like the Symington and Glenn amendments, saying that you can't give foreign aid to any country that's engaged in nuclear trafficking outside the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so, you know, that's what we know. We know there's a huge conspiracy that American people of billions of dollars in aid illegally each year to pass them to the region's only nuclear state, which, by the way, as you probably know, once offered weapons for sale like sausages to apartheid South Africa. And so that's a real conspiracy. As far as the Kennedy thing, as you know, 58% of Americans by ABC polling a couple years back said they don't believe the government's version of what happened to Kennedy, and they'd like to see more data. But the fact that they can't even get simple things like the shooter's tax return, and there are still government documents which people were waiting expectantly like good citizens for the government National Archives, which, by the way, is just a horrible organization to work with if you've ever tried to spin off some more documents. You know, they're left to their worst assumptions. I mean, people, good researchers are putting out new books reinvestigating this all of the time, and it creates enough distrust in government that, you know, just the fact that there's no confirmation seems to have absolutely no impact. But as far as, you know, me and my careful researching and requests for documents and all of that. I have requested documents at the edge of this, and everything I've seen indicates that Israelis and their lobbyists in the United States, like I. Irving Davidson and other people, hated Kennedy's guts and would have been happy with Johnson or Nixon, and were always engineering ways to get those two into place. And so I think that we need to do more work on that. But, you know, the optics, as they say, are horrible. You know, you have Kennedy working to prevent the Israelis from going nuclear, and you've got Abraham Feinberg and other operatives funding the weapons thing in direct challenge to U.S. sovereignty on U.S. soil. The optics are horrible, and they're getting worse over time. It looks more and more as though, you know, the Israelis just and their U.S. lobbies, as in the case of the American Zionist Council, AIPAC, ZOA, ADL, all of these are B'nai B'rith, all of these organizations were working in the documentary record against U.S. policy as though it was a competitive government.
Wow. And, yeah, we've also, you know, we've learned more information about the situation leading up to the Kennedy assassination in various ways. One was that, I guess there was, you know, this would be up your alley, Operation Northwoods was discovered, I believe, due to the release of files that were released under the JFK Act that was passed after Oliver Stone's film came out.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, you know, we never knew that every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, led by Lyman Lemnitzer, had signed off on a plan to kill Americans in shootings and bombings in American cities, sink an American ship on the high seas, stage a phony plane shoot down over the Caribbean, and use all of this violence to launch a war against Cuba.
Yeah, and that's very credible, and James Banford has written about it, others have written about it, and it's online, and so people can, if they're interested in knowing what government's capable of, they can certainly pull those documents down and say, oh, stage a false flag event and kill Americans so that we can enact a policy in Cuba. Okay. And it makes sense. I mean, it was certainly in league with a lot of the activities of the time. And it's, you know, it's this sort of thing that makes, I think, Americans who are doing research in this area a little bit desperate, because you've got a ton of information bottled up in the National Records Administration presidential libraries. And again, people such as the guy who was running the Nixon library are just horrible. I mean, they'll declassify documents, for example, the Kissinger documents on Israel's nuclear weapons program, and then they won't release them. You know, they'll say they're released, they'll talk to a New York Times reporter who will talk generally about it, and then do a puff piece, and then they won't actually give you the documents. They'll say, come to Yorba Linda and get a paper copy at your own expense. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Wow. And it kind of makes you wonder, to what extent is this sort of just, you know, bad, you know, people not doing their work properly, and to what extent is there sort of a conscious policy of obstructionism?
Well, I mean, it gets back to what we were talking about before, which is there's no interest in funding in the mainstream media for this. They would only get in trouble. And so it falls upon people with the least amount of resources to do it. And, of course, when you're going up against the bureaucrats at the National Records Administration, then, you know, you've got their prestige. Half of them are working to buff up the image of the particular president that their library is devoted to, and the other half really don't care about the public. And so it's just a minefield. And I'm actually surprised that anything comes out of the National Archives at all. I think Obama's at least one good thing that he's done is that he put them all on notice, saying that American history does not belong to gatekeepers at the CIA and National Security Agency and the presidential libraries, that they should not be sitting on stuff that's more than 25-year-old that could actually explain the function of government. But what happens is some of those functions are pretty ugly and indefensible.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, this kind of contradiction we see between Obama's rhetoric, which in many cases sounds perfectly reasonable and kind of reformist, and mm-hmm. then his actual policies, which include, you know, the NDAA and all kinds of other grotesque constitutional abuses. And, you know, you have to kind of wonder to what extent he would actually like to be following his better instincts and, you know, who's stopping him and whether he would be stopped in a second term. There are all kinds of rumors that, you know, good things from our perspective that he might do in the second term are scaring the bejesus out of Netanyahu, which is why Netanyahu is putting out commercials for Romney.
Yeah, I think that's true. But, and I agree that the difference between rhetoric and action is a huge gulf.
You know, in-depth discussion of Netanyahu and this crazy situation we're in now, this bizarre election season where even, you know, the Jewish Daily Forward published an op-ed saying, you know, what the hell does Netanyahu think he's doing? Jumping into this election, endorsing Romney, dissing Obama, pissing off Obama. What's that all about? It looks like, you know, if he loses this gamble, we Israelis and Israeli supporters are all screwed.
Yeah, I don't think he can lose, actually. One of the really interesting developments of the Romney campaign is who he's got as advisors. And I think just the presence of Dan Senior, former AP and author of a book called Startup Nation, which really explains how Israel's economy works, really kind of explains it all. Netanyahu cannot lose. He cannot lose by periodically ratcheting up the pressure, jumping into the elections, talking about red lines. I mean, if you look at it, he's managed to periodically dominate the airwaves. And all of this is extremely beneficial for the Israeli economy and for Israeli interests in terms of just the instability and sense of Israel in danger. If you look at a lot of the research from the Hudson Institute and other neoconservative think tanks, the idea that Israel is in peril and that there has to be massive mobilization is what really drives fundraising at AIPAC. It drives fundraising for some of the 53 organizations on AIPAC's board of executive committee. It ramps up the idea that Israel will have to mobilize and engage in exercises, creates more interest in Israeli weapons and weapons technology. And so if Dan Senior or Netanyahu or any of these other people behind this were to speak frankly about what they're doing by creating a heightened war crisis, they're really building up Israel's economy and really building up the sense that will allow increased funding to flow into a lot of these Israel lobbying organizations. So, you know, it may look outrageous from, particularly from the perspective of somebody who's been following these organizations and individuals, but it's good business. I mean, I could tell you that it's going to have great benefits for Israel, no matter what happens. Which, again, here we have Israel Aircraft Industries, which became Israel Aerospace Industries, founded by a guy who's a convicted U.S. felon, Al Schwimmer, and they're doing gangbuster business right now because AIPAC is lobbying for additional funds so that they can build out this system. And it's all flowing over to Israel, and so this system is a result of this heightened crisis. Now, that's not to say that it doesn't actually intercept some missiles once in a while or Katyusha rockets, which I don't know if they refer to those as missiles or not. But, you know, if you look into the mentality, again, of a Dan Senior or some of these neoconservative outfits, I call it neoconomics because what he proposed in the idea of Startup Nation is that the U.S. should adopt the Israeli model, which is a lot of camaraderie between former intelligence and military people who will take the technologies that they develop to, you know, wage war in Lebanon and with Palestinians and develop those into civilian and military industries for export, and that this huge system of drawing people from, you know, compulsory service into private industry is something the U.S. should replicate. I mean, they're ideologically committed to that. And if you don't have a constant state of military crisis, you can't have that kind of economic model. And so they'll talk about in the book, Dan Senior writes, how, you know, designing new latches for jet fighters to drop bombs can be adopted for the United States, where electrical cars will be able to unlatch batteries and latch them back up. And he's got this sort of weird sense that anything that the Israelis develop from their weapons technology will be immediately, you know, imported into the U.S. and adopted here because of trade preferences and things like the 1985 basic unilateral lowering of U.S. tariffs on Israeli products and services. He's got this sense that the crisis and an Israeli model will develop new markets in the United States and increased exports to the U.S. So, you know, again, whether they lose the election or whether people gradually become a little bit turned off for Netanyahu, it's still, in their perspective, extremely good for the neoeconomic system.
Put the U.S. in a state where we could have this completely psychotic illusion that we are always in danger, too. That just like the Israelis, we are constantly in terrible danger from those pesky Arabs and Muslims and their terrorism. And, of course, the reality is opposite, you know.
Yeah, it's just a horrible framework and way to live. And, you know, again, I look at a period because I think I just think we lack so much data, although there is good data out there. But, for example, in 1979, another period of crisis, uprisings, the Islamic Revolution, Central America, and Israel managed to take advantage of that crisis to, again, make the United States sign memorandums of understanding for military integration, spied on the U.S. and managed to pass a horrible trade agreement that really reversed the trading relationship with the United States, engaged in the Iran-Contra crisis, laundered all of these weapons and money, really subverted democracy in the United States by violating the Boland Amendments. And so these periods of crisis allow for all of these activities under the guise of national security that undermine democracy. They undermine civilian trade. They pour resources into military and covert operations that no sane American would want to see happening, yet occur under the cover of secrecy and crisis. And so, you know, these types of periods in time where a crisis is being whipped up are just extremely dangerous, particularly to the economy, because, you know, in this case, 1979 marked a turnaround from a decade of just economic doldrums for Israel, and the conflict and covert operations and increased aid, again, some of them fomented by espionage and by AIPAC, which was, you know, basically laundering secret documents to get a lot of these benefits, tremendous damage to the United States, tremendous benefits for Israel. So I think we're in a period like that right now, which is, you know, unfortunately, Americans, it's going unnoticed because they have no historical perspective and don't really understand any of these organizations behind it.
And I think it's also more dangerous today than in some of these earlier crises because the media, which is so much in lockstep with Israel, is owned by Zionists to a very large extent. The people who work in the key decision-making positions in our corporate media tend to be overwhelmingly Jewish Zionists. And, of course, then there are these Christian Zionists who are completely psycho, running around in the Air Force and in other places, throwing money at the political system. But since we have a media that is so rabidly pro-Zionist, you know, we lose what we used to have back when the media was, at times, a moderating influence on these crazy foreign policy adventures. You know, during Vietnam, the media coverage was not rah-rah, you know, pro-war on Vietnam by a long shot, and you had Nixon whining and complaining with Billy Graham about the Jews running the media because they saw Jewish people as being kind of liberal, leftist, peacenik, critical thinkers, you know, people outside sort of the lockstep of the military juggernaut, and they saw that as a problem. I would see that as actually an advantage.
Well,
but today that's gone because...
The American Council for Judaism, which was an extremely peace-oriented group, was really responsible for taking out AIPAC's parent organization back in the early 60s. And they had great writers and leaders like Rabbi Elmer Berger, great funding. They actually had significant funding from former Sears executives. And so, you know, they had a combination of media And what you saw is behind the scenes, the American Zionist Council, which was AIPAC's parent organization, had this covert campaign and a 1962 PR plan to dislodge in academia and in the newsrooms all of their enemies. And so they were bringing money in from overseas and funding all of these paid placements in the Saturday Evening Post, in the Atlantic magazine. They would buy all these reprints of outrageously, you know, anti-peace, chartered pieces. And they managed to dislodge the American Council for Judaism and its skeptics across the media and turn them, you know, basically into a non-entity. The only major victory that the American Council for Judaism actually won was in getting Robert F. Kennedy to finally do what Obama should do tomorrow, and that was designate the lead Israel lobbying organization as a foreign agent under the 1938 Foreign Agents Registration Act. That destroyed the organization, but of course what it did was it spun off its unincorporated lobbying division, which became AIPAC, which took over business and was, you know, back in full steam by the middle of the 1970s, and instrumental then in gaining all of these benefits and hyping up conflict by the mid-80s.
And you tell that story so well in the book, Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal. It's a piece of our history that not very many people are aware of.
No, and it's, you know, again, it's the documentary record wasn't even released until 2008. And so, you know, when I look at David Ben-Gurion, it's from a perspective of looking at his entry into the U.S. to put together a clandestine arms smuggling network as the executive of the Jewish Agency. And so by doing primary research in the National Archives, I have a different perspective, and these books have a completely different perspective on what really happened.
And it's a much more accurate one than we're likely to find anywhere else that I know of anyway. I'll be back in a moment, Kevin Barrett, with Grant Smith, whose new book is Diverge. It's about half this book, Grant, I think, is like archival material.
Yeah.
Vast amount of reproduced archival material backing up what you say.
Right.
And it makes it a lot more powerful. Has anybody tried to refute your work, you know, when you document it this well? How do they respond to it?
Well, you know, it's nobody's tried to refute it, and all of those documents are online at the Israel Lobby Archive. And so this material has been accumulating in various private and public places for, you know, ever since the 1960s. And it's pretty irrefutable. If you go and simply Google NUMEC, and it'll probably be one of the top two hits in Google, and you'll see documents in the Israel Lobby Archive revealing the visit of a covert operations team and Israel's top nuclear weapons scientist, Avraham Hermoni, to the NUMEC plant. You'll see documents and wiretaps of Zalman Shapiro talking about, you know, that he'd rather move to Israel, but his handler's telling him he's more useful inside the U.S. nuclear industry. You'll see documents where the chief of the top regulator, the Atomic Energy Commission, is presented with evidence showing that material of the signature given to NUMEC to make into submarine fuel was actually found in Israel, and his reaction to that. So all these documents, I mean, they're irrefutable. And so, you know, this material, however, this is not a best-selling book. One person who liked the book called it a police blotter, which it really is, because until this book, there have been some excellent articles, such as revisiting the NUMEC affair in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, but that's behind a paywall, and none of the documents are actually out there. Now the whole thing is out there, and I think it's pretty irrefutable that there was a diversion and that nobody involved in the crime was actually, you know, faced any consequences. And so, you know, people who come at the book, the latest review on Amazon, is that this is a great, well-researched book. But this is, again, it's like Netanyahu involved in nuclear trigger smuggling. It's so far outside the narrative. There isn't a single, I don't think, mainstream news outlet that would, you know, dare talk about it. It's been in Business Insider and mentioned in some other news sites. But, I mean, they can't use this right now. This is, you know, this is the kind of thing that would actually wake people up and cause them to question whether they're being asked to fight a war for Israeli nuclear hegemony in the Middle East as opposed to defending a defenseless country.
Which, of course, is precisely what we're being asked to defend. In fact, it might not even be that, given that, you know, it's not even clear that there is any real threat to Israeli nuclear hegemony anywhere.
No, of course not. There's no threat whatsoever. And that's, you know, that's why, to me, a lot of this looks like neoeconomics, which is all about whipping up fever and, you know, having more contracts for the Iron Dome, opening, you know, more Israeli defense contractor outlets in the United States, get them into the classified information stream and, you know, working on more projects. To me, it really, you know, I of course don't believe anything Netanyahu says, having seen what he really is in terms of his past activities. And so it's got to be something of else. If he's saying that this is true, then it almost certainly has to be false.
I think that the scene that we're seeing today is that there may be a faction forming in reaction to the kind of, you know, overextension of Israeli power in the U.S. that happened on 9/11, in my view. And, you know, if you look at the chairs of the Joint Chiefs, Richard Myers was the chair of the Joint Chiefs at the time of 9/11, I believe, and he is on everybody's list of 9/11 suspects, shall we say. Peter Pace, who followed as chair of Joint Chiefs, was more or less, you know, out of the same mold, I think. The current chair, Martin Dempsey, is said to be a basically straightforward, loyal, patriotic American who doesn't have a whole lot of use for the Zionist criminal network's control of America. And he was recently apparently sent, you know, to tell Netanyahu where to get off as far as his plans for war with Iran. And so there are these sorts of, you know, rumors and, you know, tidbits of information suggesting that there may be a kind of a showdown looming between these factions, a sort of a pro-America faction with General Dempsey and presumably Obama on board, and a Zionist crime faction of Netanyahu and his people, including the Republicans at the national mm-hmm. level. And that's the kind of thing that I think has the potential to get the truth out about 9/11, not through research, but rather through basically declaring it on TV.
Yeah.
And propagating
people. One thing that did come out in terms of even the horrible 9/11 Commission report that Americans could have interpreted correctly was that all of this unconditional support for Israel's horrible policies in the region was a direct cause of 9/11. And, you know, that alone should have been big enough.
Well, that was just like one sentence in that horrible
That's
book.
True, but that alone should have been big enough to make people who are paying attention kind of sit up and say, oh, is that actually true? And then in terms of the changing of the guard, I'm a little bit afraid of the changing of the guard. You probably heard today that Haim Saban, who is an Israeli-American, who, you know, basically donated tens of millions to the Democratic National Committee and Brookings Institution, brought in horrible people like Martin Indyk and Dennis Ross into the Clinton administration. Well, Obama just appointed this Israeli-American's wife to the United Nations to represent the U.S. in some sort of task force.
That's embarrassing.
And so, you know, you've got basically two factions of the Israel lobby yep. that are going to be in power no matter what. You've got the neocons, Pearl Wolfowitz, Dan Senor, who are their policies are, of course, just utterly bankrupt. But then you've got Haim Saban, Martin Indyk, Dennis Ross on the Democrat side, who are pretty much just as bad. And so the changing of the guard that's going to occur where a lot of these people, as soon as, you know, the administration whichever one it is, takes power are going to move into the key positions will certainly negate any disgruntling of, you know, the second and third tier. And another thing to realize is that some of the worst parts of the U.S. government, such as the Treasury's Office of OFC, which is allegedly combating financial crimes, which is ostensibly set up by AIPAC during the Bush administration, is completely intransparent, except for the top couple of people. We don't even know who's working in that unit. Are they all people from AIPAC? But what they have certainly done across two administrations is implement economic warfare against Iran in a highly intransparent manner. And so every one of these pieces of legislation that AIPAC tacks onto another bill is then implemented by AIPAC's own designated unit within the U.S. government, just a gigantic tripwire.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it sounds like we're kind of losing you a little bit. It sounds like that your cell connection is breaking. Are you in a cell?
No, I'm not. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're back.
Okay. So my point is there's no cause for optimism, and I hate to say that, but there is clearly contention within two factions who are essentially, two arms of the same body, basically.
Well, the military, though, isn't that way. I mean,
No, that's true.
There are basically no Zionists in the military, and I do think that the military is where there are folks who are really unhappy about all of the blood and tears that have been shed for these wars for Israel.
But they're going to see the same policymakers stream in. And so,
well, the hell with them. Stage a constitutional counter coup d'etat. I've been calling for a counter coup d'etat for years, and I'm going to call for it again. And of course, people say, well, that might even be worse. You know, coups d'etat generally do not produce improvements, but I think this might be an exception.
Well, it's certainly getting pretty bad, and I think Americans, you know, who are increasingly turning to alternative media and who are just very skeptical of what they're hearing from Congress and from this relatively thin veneer of policymakers, is really, you know, it's demanding change. And again, they may not get it. They may all voice opposition and then see the exact opposite being implemented. But that can't really hold forever. So I think something drastic is in the works.
What do you think about the chances for an actual war in Iran? I mean, many people, you know, like the Atlantic Monthly ran a simulation. They spent a lot of money hiring people and bringing in experts and, you know, running a simulated war in Iran back, what, 5-6 years ago. And what they found was that Iran, you know, kicked our butt. And the upshot was that these neocons who put together this whole exercise said, you know, we can't do this. You can't do a war on Iran. You know, the only way that Iran doesn't win is if you just, like, incinerate their whole country, and that would be a lose-lose proposition because, you know, public opinion would not allow that in the long run. So anyway, the upshot being that everybody says that you can't really do a war on Iran, and yet we have these war drums pounding louder and louder and louder and louder and louder. So, you know, who wins, the unstoppable force or the immovable object?
America loses, Iran loses, and there's actually no war because what's happening now is of so much more benefit. The constant tension, mm-hmm. the ability to monopolize the attentions of the U.S. government, stirring up the Muslim world, all of that has much more benefit to the people who are doing this than any actual war. So I think the actual probability of an armed conflict is low, but for people who don't think that war is possible, there's already economic warfare going on, and economic warfare can be as bad or worse than actual kinetic warfare.
Yeah, I understand that people of Iran are suffering horribly under the extreme, excruciating sanctions that, as you said, that what's it called, the Council on Something Economic, whatever, is strangling Iran, basically, and they're totally non-transparent, just a bunch of Zionists empowered to go out and do anything they want.
It's really awful, and if you've ever read, if you've read the college thesis, the Fulbright thesis of the person who ran that office during its first years, you would just utterly be horrified at the type of person who's running the office of the OFAC at Treasury. But again, they're intransparent. They will not release any list of all of their employees. If you send a FOIA asking for information about what they're doing, they'll cite the Bank Secrecy Act as reason for denying it. Very dangerous unit setting tripwires. And I've noticed that they've done a lot of their presentations at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is APAC's think tank, but not very responsive to any other sort of inquiry. So it's very dangerous what they're doing.
And so it looks to you like this strategy of tension will just continue on into the future, and the Zionists will keep raking in money and laughing all the way to the bank. Unfortunately, I don't think that's all that improbable.
Well, you know, just to give a ray of hope, if you turn a great white shark on its back, it suddenly becomes immobilized, and more information is turning the shark, but it's taking a while.
All right. Well, hey, thank you for your immense contributions to turning the shark.